Okay, thank you, Antoine. Sorry for the marathon. I mean, I hope it's not too long to have two talks.
We asked for it.
Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning. That's really tough. And that's tough on me. That's even tougher on you. So I'll try to keep with simple ideas. And so today I will talk only about frustrating magnets. I will not talk about orbital degeneracy anymore. And the title, From Theory to Experiment, was chosen on purpose because in condensed matter physics, in most cases, we try to understand results that are obtained by experimentalists, like if you think of the quantum Hall effect or heavy fermion behavior, high TC, superconductivity in the cuprate. They came as a surprise in the theories on trying to cope with these problems. But there are some notorious examples, like the Haldane prediction of the spin gap in spin one chain. And in frustrated magnetism, it seems that often theory was ahead of experiment. And probably the main reason is that chemists are only now coming up with simple but interesting enough structures to realize frustrated models, compounds that are simple enough so that we can understand the basic couplings in the system and then try to relate this to some of the predictions that were made in the late 80s and early 90s in most cases. So more specifically, I will discuss three, if I have time, such aspects. The first one is simple. It's just a warm-up. It's order by disorder, an old concept due to Jacques Villain, which has been realized now, I think, quite clearly in a two-dimensional realization of the J1, J2 model that I will discuss in the first part of this talk. The second part is concerned with low-lying singlets. There is an increasing evidence on several models, in particular the Kagome antiferromagnet for spin 1/2, that we might have a lot of low-lying singlets with a phase transition in this subspace. And we don't have a good system with the Kagome, but we have a related system which is made of weakly coupled tetrahedra, in which I think we observe a phase transition taking place only in the singlet manifold, and that where all triplet excitations are gapped. So that's quite an interesting model. This is less well, both on theory and experimental grounds. This is not as well established as this one, but I think it's clear enough to present here. And the last thing is the most recent work that was done in that field, namely the presence of magnetization plateaus. This had been predicted in the late 90s, I think, for a number of unfrustrated and frustrating models. And this has been observed now in a series of systems, but in one particular case, all things converged to make really very precise experiments possible regarding the structure of the magnetization plateau. And I will present the experiments and the calculations that were made to understand what's observed. So these three ideas are quite simple, actually. And let me try to to convey the message as simply as possible. So a very brief introduction, what we call frustration. If we have a Heisenberg model, in that context, frustration is sometimes taken as a synonym of competition between exchange integrals. But in most cases, if we have such a competition, we just end up with some helical order at the classical level. And this is just a trivial generalization of ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism. So, but what we are going to be concerned about are systems where this frustration has a more radical effect even at the classical level. So let's be specific. The frustration with antiferromagnetic coupling will take place whenever we have a non-dipotite lattice. The simplest example is a triangle. If we satisfy one bond, the third spin doesn't know how to go to satisfy both bonds together, and we have a competition and we have frustration. But in some cases, like the triangular lattice, there is a good compromise. If we make a 100-degree order of the spins, we have a non-degenerate ground state, and this is now believed to remain the ground state even for quantum spins. But in other cases, for instance, if we deplete the triangular lattice to make a Kagome lattice, where we have a number of missing sites, then the classical ground state has an infinite degeneracy. In other words, to lower, one can easily show that to lower the energy in that case, it's enough that the sum of the spin on each triangle is zero, and this can be done in an infinite number of ways. I will not enter details here, that would take too much time. But in such a case, we don't have a good starting point. We don't have a good classical ground state. So we don't know how to treat quantum fluctuations. At least we cannot just treat quantum fluctuations around a well-defined ground state. And then the effect of quantum fluctuations becomes a real problem, a typical problem of strongly correlated system. We have the starting point is degenerate, like the atomic limit of the Hubbard model. So what can we do? The first idea is that quantum fluctuations might restore some kind of long-range order. I think this was suggested the first time by Jacques Villain in the context of thermal fluctuations, starting again from a degenerate classical ground state, where he observed that thermal fluctuations might be able, by selecting some points in phase space, to restore some long-range order. Is this possible now at zero temperature for the quantum case? It was argued that yes. And one example that was studied in many, which is still actually the subject of many studies, is the J1, J2 model on the square lattice. It's defined by two antiferromagnetic coupling between nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor on the square lattice, so that we have effectively triangles, so we have frustration. And if we look at the system when J2 is larger than J1 over 2, then it's easy to convince oneself that the ground state is going to be infinitely degenerate. In fact, if J1 was 0, what one would like to build are two antiferromagnetic nail states on the two sublattices. That is, each sublattice will have nail order. And then at the classical level, there is no coupling between the lattices, because all the coupling between one spin on one sublattice and the spins on the other sublattice amount to coupling one spin to the sum of four spins, but the sum is 0 because these spins themselves are antiferromagnetically coupled. So at the classical level, for classical vectors, the energy is independent of the angle theta between the orientation of the two sublattice magnetization. And we have a classical degeneracy. But for that particular case, since you have only 1 degree of freedom, it's quite easy to make a complete analysis of the effect of quantum fluctuation by calculating to first order in a 1 over S expansion, the quantum energy and the classical energy plus the zero-point energy. The zero-point energy will depend on theta because the spectrum depends on theta, and it turns out that the energy is minimal for theta equals 0 or pi. So meaning that, for instance, the state here would correspond to theta equals 0, and we have lines of parallel spins, but when on going from one line to the other, the spin is reversed. So it was predicted, I guess, by Henley for the XY version of the model and then by Chandra and Dussault for the Heisenberg model, that we should realize when J2 over J1 is larger than 1/2, we should realize long-range order. I'm not talking about the intermediate phase, which is still the matter of debate with the spin liquid. And quite recently, my friend chemist Patrice Millet came up with the vanadium oxide, which turned out to be a very good realization of this structure. So this is the vanadium oxide. Vanadium is 4+, so it's going to be a spin 1/2. It is sitting in the black pyramids here, in vanadium O5 pyramids. And these pyramids, this system is a layered compound, and each layer consists of pyramids, but alternatively pointing upwards and downwards. And the gray objects are not pyramids, these are silicon O4 tetrahedra. So if we look at one layer, a top view of one layer, here are the pyramids pointing upwards and downwards, and here are the silicon O4 system. And a priori, we didn't know, but we expected that the dominant coupling would be the coupling between first neighbor and second neighbor. One could wonder why the second neighbor would be important here. But because of the geometry, the second neighbors are actually in the same plane. The vanadium are sitting around here, whereas the first neighbor is sitting above. So this is exactly a situation where we can expect to have, quantum chemistry reasons, both couplings taking significant values. So it's difficult, of course, to grow big single crystals as usual. And in particular, the chemists usually are not equipped to big crystals. So the simplest thing to do is NMR in the first place, because you can even do it on a powder or on very small crystals. And this was performed by in the team of Pietro Caretta in Pavia. And the answer was crystal clear. So that was a very lucky case. So this is again the lattice where now I have shown explicitly where the lithium is sitting. In that system, presumably because the couplings are too small, it's impossible to see the vanadium NMR line, but it's possible to see the lithium NMR line. And at a high temperature, there is a single line for the lithium. And when we lower the temperature below 2.83 Kelvin precisely, there is a splitting of the line. And at low temperature, we end up with three lines. And this is a signature of collinear order, that it's not Nail order, because lithium is sitting here. If we had Nail order, all lithium sites would still be equivalent in the ordered phase, because each lithium would sit between two spins that are up and down respectively. Whereas if we have collinear order, we have three types of lithium site. One of them is sitting between two spins pointing in one direction, the other one in two spins pointing in the opposite direction, and two of them are sitting between two spins antiparallel. So under such circumstances, NMR for, if we had the Nail state, would still have only one line at low temperature for lithium, whereas it should have three lines if we had collinear order, and yes, very clear that it has three lines.
Possible explanation for those three lines. I mean, this is one scenario that would give rise to three lines.
Well, but usually...
It's not collinear. Other ones.
Well, I... which other one? If you tell me, I'll tell you if I can exclude it. That's the only one we thought of, you know, that was so natural in that context. We expect either or, and that was not Nail, so it has to be collinear. I think there are more precise, I mean, there are measurements now in single crystals related to the orientation of the spin. I think NMR people have now all kind of evidence that this is true, including actually the motion of domain walls. But in the first place, you know, usually you have either a line or line splitting in two or continuum. If you have three lines, it's really because of the geometry, and I cannot think of another simple explanation.
Is the magnitude of the splitting quantitative information?
That... Yes, so there is some qualitative on the hyperfine coupling then, and yeah, there is a whole, I mean, if you're interested in all the details, there is really all the NMR information, which I don't know all the details of, are contained in this long paper where everything is reported, including the phase transition. I mean, I could give an entire talk on all aspects, but I think I wanted just to convey this simple message, plus the fact that this is not the whole story. Because I think it's clear we have collinear order, but there is more to it. And this is where things are getting a little bit more interesting, maybe. Because quantum fluctuations do not lift completely the degeneracy. We have two possibilities. We can have a state with rows of parallel spins, or we can have a state with column of parallel spins, and they are not equivalent. I mean, you cannot go from one to the other by your rotation in a global rotation of the spins, because a line of parallel spin would remain parallel, whereas in that state it is antiferromagnetic. So we have two states, and it was suggested by Chandra, Coleman, and Larkin in 90 that we should have an Ising transition here. Now, if we had just an Ising transition realizing one domain, I don't think that this would be this would have any impact on NMR, because NMR is probing the local structure. But in fact, we believe that there should be another effect, namely if we couple the system to the lattice, it will be coupled to the lattice. And it's very likely, a priori, that if we have to choose between these states, still, since this state breaks the rotational symmetry, the lattice should adapt. So what we have done with a postdoc in Lausanne, Federico Becca, was to study that problem in the adiabatic limit, that is assuming that the phonons are very slow. So what we do is look for the best energy configuration, assuming some elastic constant for the phonon, and letting the lattice react. On a 16-side lattice using exact diagonalization, we found three different phases. One phase which remains undistorted, one phase which is orthorhombic. This, we believe, is a finite size effect. I'll come to it later. And there is an intermediate phase which is dimerized, which presumably would correspond to one of the possible ground states that was suggested around J2 over J1 equals 0.5. But we find it only very high in the phase diagram. On this axis, this is a spin-phonon coupling. And we have no evidence that this phase is going to extend down to 0.5. So that's still a little bit of a mystery. But yes.
Can you explain just a little more how the magnetic part of the Hamiltonian was coupled to the elastic part in that calculation?
Yes. Do I have it here, or do I have I have it later, maybe for? I think I didn't write it here. I have it later for another system. So let me show this these slides here, maybe. Because that's always the same trick. What we mean by adiabatic limit is this. The Hamiltonian is still magnetic Hamiltonian.
Yes.
We have an elastic term. The variables are the bond lengths between the magnetic atoms, and the coupling, the exchange integral, depend linearly on the displacement. And this number here corresponds to the exponent you would have for the dependence. And typical values are in the range 6 to 12 experimentally in different transition metal oxides. Although there is no real systematics of that. I was discussing this last week again with Cheong, because now for all these studies we need really good estimates of this parameter. And he told me he did a work 10 years ago on cuprates. And the previous work was 30 years ago on some iron compound, and that's about it. So we don't have really experimental evidence.
This law is varied in some intermediate range of distances.
Displacements in that game, unless you...
exponential regime also.
Yes, but these displacements, you know, unless you go... Cheong had a huge displacement, which was 10%, but here you're talking about 0.1%. So it's definitely linear in that in that range.
Oh, sure, it's linear in that.
Yes?
And then you consider only bond stretching forms.
Yes.
Right? Because, I mean, I think in most real compounds, it's bond bending mode which couple these molecules, no?
Okay. This is a very effective model, again, we're working with, because I think any detailed description of the lattice dynamics should include the oxygen. So I think the first couplings would be the springs between the copper and the oxygen, or the vanadium and the oxygen, which we do not include. We just have an effective model. The problem is, imagine making a very precise lattice dynamics. How are you going to relate the J value to the geometry? We have no idea. So we go for the simplest thing, which is some effective coupling. And it's very difficult to know. You know, imagine moving a little bit in oxygen. How are you going to change J? So I think to be too precise on the lattice side would not bring anything. So.
So this was Heisenberg, right? The model you said had an Ising transition.
Yeah, the Ising transition is related to the two helical state. It's not related to the magnetic moment. We have locally two possibilities. That was the argument. So locally we can either choose to build the helix in this direction or in this direction, and at low temperature we should build domains. And they should be, even in two dimensions, a finite temperature transition for that model.
Right. So, but these two things vary, in fact, only on the direction of the spins with respect to the lattice. If you rotate the spin, then you recover the other one.
No, it's not a global rotation. That's what I was saying. You have a line of parallel spins.
Also, you
have a column of parallel spins.
Okay.
So it's not a global rotation in spin space. You have also to rotate the lattice. So these are really two different states.
Because I guess there is no spin-orbit coupling at all in the Hamiltonian.
No, we didn't put any spin-orbit coupling.
Sorry for that, just a much more basic question. So for the purely magnetic model, what is now the established...
Established, I think there is no established phase diagram.
You
could ask Luca Capriotti, who has one of the latest version of the phase diagram. I think it's clear it's clear between, say, 0.4 and 0.6 or 0.5 something, there is a spin-liquid phase. I think everybody agrees on
that.
I think so, because no technique is able to stabilize magnetic long-range order from one side to the other. So I think this is clear. Now, in the intermediate phase, whether we have some kind of we have degeneracy or symmetry breaking, that's not clear. I mean, this is still ongoing discussion. So I don't want to enter enter that. But if we couple to the lattice, one possibility is that the lattice is anyway going to remove somehow this phase. Although I don't know. So yes. We have an Ising, so we believe there is an Ising transition. The Ising transition coupled to the lattice will make a distortion. And if we do now that we know the relevant phases, we can we did also some spin wave calculation to study more precisely what happens in the thermodynamic limit. And it seems indeed that the lattice instability occurs for infinitesimal spin phonon coupling, like for the Heisenberg chain, which is unstable towards distortion in that limit for infinitesimal spin coupling. So whenever you are in that phase, you expect the actual crystal to actually break the rotational symmetry to go into an orthorhombic phase. And this is an analog of the spin-Pyrholz transition, but here we break the rotational symmetry, not the translational symmetry.
And you're also saying that the elastic couplings want to get rid of the exotic phase, basically, right?
Yes, they want to leave the degeneracy. It's always the same idea. If you look at several ways of lifting the degeneracy.
It's sad but expected.
Yeah. And if quantum, it's always the case. We'll see later in the magnetization plateau that, again, I think the same kind of physics. So why did I mention that? Because there is still a mystery about that system, which is concerned with the silicon NMR. Silicon is sitting in a very symmetric position, and so you do not expect any line splitting at the silicon site in that system. Silicon is sitting just in the middle, and so whatever you do nil or collinear, you do not expect any line splitting because the total moment coming from the ordered spin will be zero at the silicon site. So, and indeed there is no line splitting at the transition, but what is observed is a shift. It looks a little bit like a first-order transition. Working is in progress to quantify all these statements. But there is a clear displacement of the line between the high and the low temperature phase. And this is, I was told by my friends experimentalists in NMR, that this is typical of a structural distortion. There is no way we could study the structural distortion by other means so far. But it's clear that there is some structural distortion. And now there are good reasons to believe that this might be indeed a distortion that is due to the effect, to this coupling to the lattice. It starts above the transition as it should, above the magnetic transition. You hope to break the rotational symmetry before you actually order the system. So that's about what I wanted to say on that particular system. Quantum fluctuations can just lift the degeneracy and produce some kind of long-range order with some other marginal effects like this Ising transition. But if that was all about frustrated magnetism, that would be not very very interesting. So now let's move to more exotic effects in frustrated magnets. So the next effect I want to discuss is the presence of low-lying singlets. And to start with, it's useful to think of the low-dimensional quantum antiferromagnets we know in terms of their spectrum for finite systems. So here we can plot the energy and classify the states as a function of the total spin square. And two situations are well documented in the field of quantum antiferromagnetism. One of them is long-range order. On a finite system, the ground state is expected to be a singlet, but in the thermodynamic limit, we expect to be able to have some symmetry breaking. And this will be, in that context, this will be seen as a tower of state, a given structure, where in particular for each value of the total spin, we have a low-lying state, which is going to collapse onto the ground state when the system size increases. This is the so-called Anderson's tower of state, because that was suggested as a solution by Anderson, I think, in his 1952 paper on antiferromagnetism, as a way to lift the paradox between having a singlet and having long-range order in an antiferromagnet. So this now has been well established in the context of the square lattice and other ordered system, like even the triangular lattice. So that's one first possibility. We have a lot of low-lying states, but they are magnetic with arbitrary large values of the total spin. The other situation, which is well documented, is that of a spin singlet triplet gap. This was first suggested for spin 1 chains, but now the most popular example is probably that of ladders. On ladders with an even number of legs, we expect again to have a spin gap. That is, the first magnetic excitation on a finite system, it's always lying at a finite energy, but this energy does not go to zero when you increase the system size. And this is the first excitation of the system. So that's kind of the two paradigms we have for quantum antiferromagnets. It came as a big surprise when Claire Lullier and collaborators studying the spin 1/2 Kagome antiferromagnet on a finite lattice realized that the spectrum is not at all of any of these two kinds in that case. Well, the Kagome is, the classical Kagome is again here. We have a very huge degeneracy. I could comment on that, but I will leave it now. What they found on a finite system, here this is the spectrum for a cluster with 36 sites, and they calculated all the states up to a finite energy, so that was kind of a tour de force for a numerical, on numerical ground. But anyway, they succeeded in getting all the low-lying states, and they realized the following. Here, you have the density, the number of states, if you want to integrate, the density of states for the singlet states. This is this line here, continuing here. The broken line is for triplet states, and that would be the sum of both. Not very useful. And so what they realized is that in the low energy sector, you have a very large number of singlet states. And it seemed that the first triplet occurs at a finite energy. There is some finite size scaling. It seems that we indeed have a triplet gap, but in the triplet, we have many singlets. And when I say many, to give you an idea, on 36 sites, I think they had 153 singlets. So the spectrum is completely different from the point of view, you know, of people doing exact diagonalization from the spectrum of any antiferromagnet. So there was something very spectacular. And the number of low-lying singlets increases exponentially with the size of the cluster. So it means that it's really a proliferation. It's not just a finite size effect. The number seems to scale with the size. And I will not enter the details here, but it's possible to account to a certain extent for this behavior in the context of an RVB interpretation by looking at the subspace of short-range resonating valence bond object, that is, all coverings of the Kagome lattice with singlet dimers. And if we work in this variational basis, we seem to be able to reproduce satisfactorily what is known about this low-energy singlet sector. The problem is, the reason why I'm going to stop here for that Kagome is that we are still lacking a good Kagome spin 1/2 antiferromagnet. And there is talking to all kinds of chemists, everybody is certain that it should be possible, but nobody has been able to come up with a good case. The only good Kagome antiferromagnet we know have a spin 5/2 or larger. Spin 3/2 is difficult. It's chromium oxide, which has bilayers. It's already quite dirty. And spin 1/2, we know only these systems that are partly metallic, so it's very different. So anyway, I don't think at the moment there is any hope to observe this this physics in any magnets, just in the context of the Kagome antiferromagnet.
What's known about the density of states, I mean, of singlets? Does it increase like the energy or energy?
So the number, the thing is, you know, you have only a few sizes. So what you can do is count the number of singlets up to a certain energy from the ground state.
Yes.
And see how this scales. And this scales like 1.15 to the power of the number of sites. It increases exponentially. So you're feeling really, if you count the number of singlets below a certain energy, you're producing a large number of singlets, which are not related to triplet combinations because triplets are much higher.
What power law you expect for a specific heat based on that kind of?
That's an extremely difficult question. I tried to convince myself and I couldn't. It's very tricky. Try to calculate the specific heat of fermions on the lattice. It's impossible. You will always find that it's exponential. There is no way you can get the linear behavior even from huge lattices. So here you have, if you don't know the analytic form of the density of states, you're out. It's impossible. So it's an important question. I personally, if I had to bet, I would bet it's linear. Most people think it's quadratic. So, but
that's because of experiments. Nobody knows.
But I would. We worked actually on some models with random matrices to try to reproduce the spectrum, understand the density of state. It's very difficult. We didn't get really convincing results, so nothing was published. I still believe it's linear, but I cannot answer it for sure. So if one day this is measured, then we will come back to it. But, so there is no hope to observe, I think, low-lying singlets right now in frustrated magnets that exist in compounds.
Sorry,
but
yes, excuse me. You mentioned this system which is spin-half, but which is apparently metallic. Which compound is that?
So that's how is it called? Is it a dilophosite? That was a compound synthesized by Cava in the early 90s. I know Claudine Lacroix has worked on that, but the system is marginally insulating at best. So there are other fluctuations. It's not a clear-cut anti-Kagome system, I believe. But there is another way, a simpler way, to get low-lying singlets in the system if we have weakly coupled tetrahedra. If you take a plaquette, four spins with two types of coupling along the plaquette and on the diagonal, J1 and J2, and if you look at the low-lying, the spectrum of this object, when J2 equals J1, which means that you have the topology of a tetrahedron, the ground state turns out to be a two-fold degenerate singlet, and separated still from a gap equals to J from the first triplet excitation, which turns out to be threefold degenerate. One of these triplets is twofold degenerate. So if we can come up with a system with a weakly coupled tetrahedra, we expect to have a large number of low-lying singlet excitation, 2 to the power n, where n would be the number of tetrahedra, and a gap to triplet excitation. So a natural candidate for tetrahedra is the pyrochlore structure, which is the spinel that Chong discussed last week. But in that case, the tetrahedra are not weakly coupled. The system can be thought of as a system of coupled tetrahedra, but the inter-tetrahedra coupling is as large as the intra-tetrahedra coupling. And besides, again, we don't have a good spin 1/2 system. Although for tetrahedra, it wouldn't matter. I mean, whatever. If you take a system with spin S, the ground state is actually a 2S plus 1 degenerate singlet, so there is still singlet degeneracy. But it's not clear in that case that this singlet will still be well separated. But we came up by chance, again with my friend chemist Patrice Millet, across a copper oxide, which seems to have precisely this weakly coupled tetrahedra. So here is the here is the structure. I don't know how well it is represented. You can think of the system as spin tubes aligned one to the other. The copper are represented here or here, and the copper sides make plaquettes, but if you look at them from the side, they make tetrahedra. Do I have a better? No, I don't have a better picture. It's very difficult to show this system clearly, but the four copper sides here are an almost perfect form an almost perfect tetrahedron. Still, the quantum chemistry is different from all the bonds. So when we first saw the system, I thought that this was going to be a spin tube with well-defined plaquettes because this bond should be different from this bond from the magnetic point of view. And the first thing to do was to measure the susceptibility. And the susceptibility turned out to be quite interesting. Here it's shown. We have two of the system, the chlorine and the bromine. The chlorine actually has an antiferromagnetic phase transition, so I will not discuss it in more detail. The bromine system has a very rapid decrease of the susceptibility at low temperature. But what is interesting is that when trying to fit the susceptibility, since the tetrahedra are supposed to be far apart, I tried to fit the susceptibility just with one plaquette with two adjustable parameters, J1, J2. And it turns out that the only good fit you get is when J1 equals J2. So for some reason, which we clearly do not understand at the moment, at the quantum chemistry point of view, it seems that the system wants to be in a limit where the J1 and J2 coupling are indeed comparable, which would mean that the first excitation of each tetrahedron is a singlet, and we should expect to have many low-lying singlets in that system. So that was the first kind of screening at the chemist stage to see the magnetic property. This system looked interesting enough, and we decided we wanted to understand more about its low energy properties. If we have low-lying singlets, then you have to think, what do we do to measure singlets? Because if you do neutron, you see triplets. And the best specific heat would be of course a possibility, quite indirect. But there is one spectroscopy which measures only singlets, which is the Raman spectroscopy. In Raman, usually in a magnet, you see the two magnon spectrum because it takes two magnons to make a singlet. But if we have low-lying singlets, we would expect to observe a singlet signal in the Raman spectrum. So here we send the sample to Peter Lemmens, who was in Aachen at that time, to do the Raman spectroscopy. And here are the results he obtained for the bromine system. So these are the results are listed for different temperatures, and already when you get to low temperature, what you observe is first of all a big structure which has the shape of a pyramid, and which is exactly at two times what we would estimate to be the gap for our isolated tetrahedron. So we would interpret this feature, which is present in all the temperature range, as being the two magnon contribution to the system, that is, singlet excitations built out of two magnons made of on separate tetrahedra. This is this is qualitative because we don't understand the shape of the spectrum, but at least the energy matches. And then what happens? There is something really interesting then going on at low temperature. If you are at high temperature, you have a quasi-elastic peak in the Raman spectrum. But if you lower the temperature below, by the time you reach temperatures of the order of 10 Kelvin or so, you start building, some spectral weight coming out of the quasi-elastic peak and building up a very large singlet peak at low frequency. And this singlet peak, we believe now, it should be interpreted as coming from the second singlet in each copper plaquette. The interpretation is difficult. There are experiments going on. It does not seem that this object is a bound state coming from the Raman spectrum. That's the most important thing, because when you have two magnon spectrum, you could have bound states, but the behavior is expected to be quite different. The bound states should be close below but close to the continuum, whereas this peak emerges from the quasi-elastic peak at low temperature.
This compound is insulating, right?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm talking only about insulators today.
Are there neutrons?
Not yet. They are under progress. Louis-Pierre Regnault has a sample now. Patrice Millet succeeded in building a good crystal of that system. And so a large crystal, a neutron, inelastic neutron scattering is underway now in Grenoble. Now, at low temperature, there seems to be a phase transition, when you have this quasi-elastic peak. And indeed, in the specific heat, there is something in that system. So if you compare, this is the specific heat of the chlorine system. It has a typical shape of an antiferromagnetic transition. When you increase the magnetic field, TC is pushed down to lower temperature, which is, again, typical of antiferromagnets. Whereas for the bromine system, there is a very weak, very small accident in the specific heat, but it increases with magnetic field. So that's another indication that there is a phase transition around in this temperature range that we are now trying to clarify its nature. But it doesn't seem to be magnetic ordering. This is very atypical of an antiferromagnetic ordering in the system. And so at the moment, the scenario we have would be that we have a system of weakly coupled plaquettes that are more or less good tetrahedra. And the phase transition would be associated with the chirality. I realize I should show this spectrum. If we go back to the ground state of a tetrahedron, I don't know why, you can lose the analysis. The Hamiltonian of one tetrahedron is just proportional to the total spin square. So the ground state is going to be the state with the singlet. And if you make the product of four spin one half and you make the algebra, you end up with two singlets and three triplets and one quintuplet. So the ground state is two singlets. And this we can implement in a model by introducing another degree of freedom of pseudo spin one half to describe this other degree of freedom that will distinguish between the two singlets. And in that particular case, since singlets are non-magnetic, so non-degenerate, that's the only degree of freedom that remains for tetrahedron at low temperature.
But there's no reason why those singlets will be degenerate, right?
They are degenerate only if J2 equals J1.
Okay. So it's accidental, this heresy?
It's more or less accidental. So the hope is that if this is to make sense, the splitting of the singlet should be smaller than the inter-tetrahedral coupling, so that we're still able to build a band of singlets. Otherwise, the state would be separate. Now, you know, the interpretation is going on. We have, animated discussions with our friends, German colleagues, as to what the explanation is. We can propose at the moment a hand-waving explanation of what could happen. At above TC, J2 is close to J1 enough so that we have good tetrahedra. We have a two-magnon state at 2J1, and we have all the singlets buried into the elastic peak. What's going on? What's that?
I don't know what it is.
Oh my god.
Has the tetrahedral symmetry?
Well, it has.
Yeah, it's huge.
You want to stick it in a glass or what? Thanks, Gabby. Oh my god. Do we have a glass? Okay.
It's a living thing.
Okay, very good. Good job. Carrying the glass around.
It actually makes it move.
What is it?
It must be very strong. Yeah, this weight in relation to the
hitch. Put a paper below and carry it away.
Put the
solid. Sorry. No problem. I've never seen such a piece.
Can we get it on the video?
But what is it?
I don't know.
Okay, so now the thing is captured.
Okay, now it's a new.
Okay, let's read.
So, research topic.
Which secretary office you're in?
You're gonna have to take a picture. Okay.
He
came in twice and he's trying to see. He was searching for something.
Really?
Remember that? Yeah.
Just now?
About 30
yeah,
minutes ago.
I'm sure that's it then. You should go give it to him. He collects bugs, right? The laser guy.
Because he came in twice at least. Searching for something.
Who?
The laser guy from the Renaissance? No. Huh?
The guy who gave the talk on towns. He collects bugs, right?
I see.
Yeah, and Wei says he was in here looking for something earlier.
Expensive bug.
So the conscious physicists continue.
It's like Alien, you know. Suddenly, the beast comes down.
Biological awareness.
So anyway, the crisis is over. So let's go back to physics. So what we believe happens is the following: above the critical temperature. If we have almost perfect tetrahedra, we expect the singlets to be more or less degenerate, and they could be buried in the quasi-elastic peak. Whereas below TC, the degeneracy between these states might be lifted by something like a Jahn-Teller distortion. But Jahn-Teller not atomic, but at the level of one tetrahedron, you lift the degeneracy to gain some magnetic energy. This would mean a splitting of the two times of chiralities. And the singlets would be then at a finite energy, and they could build up a band at a finite energy. So that's very hand-waving arguments, but a possible scenario why we would get, at low temperature, these singlets at a finite energy coming out of the quasi-elastic peak. This system is of course, a little bit trickier than you would hope it to be. In particular, there is some residual magnetism. If the picture, the simple picture we have in mind was correct, the system should be totally non-magnetic, and we should expect to have a gap to magnetic excitation. But this is not the case. TC depends on the magnetic field, so there is some coupling between the critical temperature and the magnetic field. More importantly, now that we have data that I don't show, they are not published yet, but there are data for the magnetization. And the magnetization is very small at low field. It raises very slowly, but it is non-zero. And that's a problem. We believe now we are working on a model where we introduce some Sierozinski-Moria coupling, because these bonds are very have a very low symmetry, so Sierozinski-Moria interaction is possible. And this could give some residual magnetism to the system. But this is not the only possibility. The only problem is the pyramid-like shape of the two magnon state. This was never observed in any other system before. At least that's what Peter Lemons told me. He's a good expert of Raman in quantum magnets. And this is a very strange density of state. Yes?
This pyramid-like shape is observed above TC.
Above and below.
Above and below.
Above and below, everywhere. This is really regardless of the temperature. And always very, you know, I can't put back the spectrum. It's... TC is about, so here everything is a little bit pushed down for the high temperature to have everything on the same curve. But the, for instance, that here this is 22 Kelvin, there is also a pyramid shape, and if you enlarge, it's really very much like a pyramid. So, a pyramid is the convolution of two rectangles. So the idea is that you have maybe a density of state for the triplet excitation, which is more or less a rectangle or a potato or something quite smooth. And if you make the self-convolution, you would obtain such a spectrum. The problem is that in Raman spectroscopy, usually you have only Q equals zero, so you do not make the convolution. But since we have three triplets here that are degenerate, there is some hope that the somehow the presence of three triplets might explain such a a shape, but again, this is wishful thinking so far. We have no calculation to support these ideas. Wolfram Brenisch is working on this, on trying to understand the shape. He's done a lot on Raman scattering in quantum magnets. So we think now these other aspects of frustrated magnetism, that namely that we could have low-lying singlets, seems to be observed, we believe, in that system with weakly coupled tetrahedra. So we could have phase transition with no or very little magnetic component. And now let me move to the last part of the talk, namely the magnetization curve. So let me start with a very simple introduction to give you an idea why, in a frustrated magnet, the magnetization curve might be interesting. And I think the simplest example where to explain this is a ladder. Consider a ladder in a magnetic field with J perpendicular and J parallel. And if you start from the limit where J parallel equals zero, then we have for each rung of the ladder a single ground state and a triplet excited state. And if you put the system in a magnetic field, one of the triplets, because of the Zeeman splitting, goes down. The singlet is unchanged, and at a certain critical field, the triplet is below the singlet, and the magnetization curve is expected to jump to one abruptly. Then if we switch out quantum fluctuation in that picture, and if J parallel is different from zero, then without doing any calculation, you expect this transition to be broadened, and you expect the magnetization to raise starting at a critical field HC1 and to reach saturation at a critical field HC2. You can put these ideas on a quantitative level by making a strong coupling expansion in that system, which I think is really the physically the most simple, the simplest way to understand things. You switch on J parallel in perturbation and you look at the effective model. Close to the critical field, since we have a singlet crossing with only one of the triplets, we have only two relevant states for this strong coupling expansion, namely the singlet, which we will denote with a pseudospin sigma, sigma z being up, and one of the triplet, the one crossing the singlet, which would correspond in this language to sigma z down. And then doing a perturbation expansion to first order in J parallel, the Hamiltonian has already, the degeneracy is lifted, and the effective Hamiltonian in this pseudospin space is just an XXZ Hamiltonian, which with an effective coupling in the XY direction equals to J parallel, and with an effective coupling in the Z direction equals to J parallel over 2, plus an effective magnetic field given here. So this is an XXZ Hamiltonian, but it's useful conceptually to translate it using the Jordan-Wigner transformation into fermions, and this mapping is exact at that stage for one-dimensional system. And what one ends up with is a system of spinless fermions in one dimension in that case, with the Hopping integral T equals J parallel over 2, and the repulsion coming from the Z term, a repulsion between first neighbors, V equals to J parallel over 2 also. So now, in that case, this means we have spinless fermions. We are filling up a band. And in that case, for that particular model, V is not very strong, and so the system has no metal insulated transition. When we fill the band, the density is going to raise smoothly with the chemical potential, and that would be our interpretation. But then this gives the idea to look at the in the same language at frustrated ladders. Consider now a ladder with diagonal couplings J prime. And again, play the same game. Do a strong coupling expansion starting from the large J perpendicular, switching on in perturbation both J and J prime. Then in terms of the sigma of the pseudo-spin language, you end up with these couplings. And if you translate it again with a Jordan-Wigner transformation, still possible because we have couplings just between nearest neighbors, so it's totally straightforward. You end up again with a system of spinless fermions. But now the kinetic energy in the Hopping integral is reduced by the presence of G prime, where the repulsion is increased. And so it's well known for that system from Bethe Ansatz, a result due to Ovchinnikov, I believe, in 1970, that there is a metal insulator transition for that particular model when V over T equals 2. And V over T equals 2 means J prime equals J over 3. So for that system, for this frustrated ladder, if J prime is just one third of a J, which is not such a big number, we expect to have a metal insulated transition in the fermionic language, meaning a magnetization plateau in the magnetic language. So if I go back now, we can make a sketch of what the magnetization is going to look like. In the fermionic language, we can plot the density of the function of the chemical potential, and we start filling the band at a certain value of the chemical potential, and then we have a metal insulator transition, so we have a jump in the chemical potential, and at a certain value we start again filling the band, and this in this language corresponds to the charge gap in the insulating phase. In terms of the magnetization, the same curve, the magnetization of the function of magnetic field will raise and will exhibit what is called the plateau in that case. So there is a very simple control calculation to show that frustration itself can lead to magnetization plateau. And this calculation is useful because I think it gives the right idea for generalization to higher dimension at a qualitative level. Namely, frustration in that game is going to decrease the kinetic energy of the triplets you're creating on each bond, but it's at the same time going to increase the repulsion between them, and as a result, you can have metal insulated transitions and magnetization plateau. So that's a very simple idea that has been developed in a series of papers in that context.
Can you explain again? I mean, you start with a level crossing. You have a singlet
and
the
one, yes,
a triplet, and then you apply H and the levels cross, basically.
Yes.
Then you do a little bit more refined treatment by mapping it onto.
Yeah. So, exactly, the treatment is just the following. We sit at that point. At that point, for each rank, we have one singlet, one triplet, so we have two degrees of freedom. And by switching on the coupling J parallel, we get an effective Hamiltonian.
And why does the magnetization have a plateau there?
No, here that's just saturation.
Uh-huh.
And that would be saturation. So here that would mean
right. The
band is empty, the band is full.
You need J prime.
And if I put J prime, then there is we can have a strong enough repulsion, and this would make a plateau here at half the magnetization.
But that's non-trivial, right? That requires some many-body analysis.
Sure, it's the mode transition.
But that's what this is the mode transition for the one-dimensional spin experiment model. That was, this is Betéanzat's result.
What does the magnetization map in the language of the mode transition?
That's the density. And the magnetic field, that was this plot. The magnetization is equivalent to the density,
right.
And the magnetic field to the chemical potential.
Right.
So the jump, the jump in the chemical potential is a jump in magnetic field, and it's a magnetization plateau.
Right. And why is this half field?
In that case, it is half field because the effective coupling is just a repulsion between nearest neighbors for spinless fermions in 1D. And this model has just one metal insulated transition at half filling.
Yeah, but what fixes the system to be at half filling?
Nothing. If you measure, what we're doing experimentally, what you do in that game is to sweep
so
the magnetic field. Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have a way to vary the doping from zero electron to a field band, if you wish, in that language. Usually what you do is, in electronic system, you fix to sit somewhere, but here we are going to sweep.
Right.
That's what makes actually these quite interesting. It's much richer. So that's the basic picture. There are a number of systems where magnetization plateaus have been observed, but one of them is the most spectacular, I think, is a system, a copper oxide. And the formula is transform copper to bore or three two times. Which was synthesized actually in Germany in the mid-90s, but they didn't study its physics, and the investigation of that system started with Kageyama and collaborators at the ISSP. So this system is made of layers, and the copper, I don't have the total structure here, but it's a layered system, and the copper in each layer have this geometry. They are represented here as red spots, and the couplings we have two types of couplings, one between nearest neighbors of copper and other couplings relating these dimers to each other. It turns out that this model is equivalent to a model introduced in 1981 by Shastri and Sutherland, which can be thought of as a square lattice with a J1, J2 model, but where you put only some J2 neighbors. And Shastri and Sutherland studied that model because for that case, they could prove that if the J coupling is strong enough meaning of the order 2 in their variational calculation, then the ground state is actually just a product of singlets on these bonds. Because once you've put a singlet on each of these bonds, all other couplings can be thought of as coupling one spin to both ends of a singlet, and this drops from the Hamiltonian. So the wave function where you have a singlet on each dimer is an exact eigenstate, and it turns out to be the ground state in a large part of the parameter range. So that was again found independently actually by Miyahara and Ueda in 1999 when they saw the system. They realized that you have a ground state which is a product of singlets, and that there should be a triplet gap to the system. But the real interest in the system was raised when Kageyama et al. Measured the magnetization curve, which is represented here, concentrate on one of these curves only, because they realized that you have magnetization plateaus, small but visible, at 1 over 8 of the saturation, 1 over 4. This is the beginning of a plateau at 1/3. They now have data up to 70 Tesla. And presumably there are other plateaus, but nobody could go further with magnetic field so far in that system.
What fixes the height of the plateaus?
You mean where they're located?
What physics underlies those numbers, one height, one fourth?
Well, that's what we will see. I mean, it's a combination between a long-range repulsion and very small kinetic energy. And at each commensurability, there is a priori a possibility of having a plateau. And in that particular system, it seems that we are realizing this sequence of plateau.
In the model you had explained just before, was the plateau exactly for one half?
Oh, yes. In the ladder, it's exactly one half, because this is a metal insulated transition at half filling. So you expect to have this kind of plateau only at commensurability. So the rest of the talk, now if you give me 5 more minutes, and then is just devoted to the investigation of this plateau by NMR and high field NMR and such results that we've been carrying on recently. So the first thing Miyaha and collaborators did was to try to find a plateau. It's difficult because on a finite system you have plateaus everywhere because the magnetization can have only jumps, and you have to try to see which plateaus are physical. At the same time, to write down an effective Hamiltonian for the triplet in the case of this model turns out to be very difficult because you have three body terms entering. So it's a tricky issue. What they did was to consider hardcore bosons with some repulsion that was consistent with the Hamiltonian. And they found that for each plateau that they could identify and that was identified experimentally, they could come up with a structure that would correspond to having triplets in blue here localized at certain spots between singlets. In the case of the 1 over 8 plateau, two states have energies that are essentially equal within the accuracy of the approximation, namely one structure where we would have a square unit cell for super lattice of triplets, and one where we would have a tilted unit cell, a rhomboid unit cell, for the triplets. The idea that since the triplets have a repulsion, you want to put them as far apart as possible, and it turns out that at this filling there are two ways to do it that are essentially equivalent at that level of approximation. So it's clear in any case that if we are at a plateau, we expect some spin texture, and then Takigawa was brave enough to give it a chance and try to measure it. So there was a lucky aspect of the data. If you look at the plateau, it occurs at it's not very clear. It occurs around 27 Tesla. And this is these data are taken at very low temperature. And so it turns out that in Grenoble, it is still possible. I don't know for how long, but still possible to do. To do NMR in high fields. I'm sorry, I had some problems with the slide, but I think you can see. And so Takigawa contacted Claude Berthier in Grenoble, and they decided to try to do NMR in the plateau at 27.6 Tesla to try to detect the spin texture. So at 26 Tesla, before the plateau, the copper NMR spectrum is very simple. Copper is the nuclear spin is 3/2. So you have three lines and you have two isotopes, so you expect six lines with some overlap. So this means only one type of copper site. That's already complicated. But when you enter the plateau at 35 millik, you have to go at very low temperature. Then you see a spin texture that is many, many different copper sites. It's a whole forest of peak. The central line should be here. We have magnetization on both sides of the central line. And there are at least 11 different sites needed to account for the very detailed structure. So it means they were really puzzled when they had actually only preliminary results. This is where they contacted us to try to understand where this could come from, because in the naive pictures you would expect to have triplet or singlet and essentially two types of sites. So that's where we started to think about this trying to calculate the spin texture. And this turns out to be technically a difficult problem. The effective model is very, very difficult. You know, there is no simple bosonic theory you can do in the way you can do it for other models to account for this, because the effective model is complicated. So the only way out seems to be to do exact diagonalization on the system. Then you make the assumption that in the thermodynamic limit at the plateau, there is an eightfold degenerate ground state, but we will observe only one of these states because they are not coupled in the thermodynamic limit. And then to do calculation, what you would like to do is to take a finite system with periodic boundary condition, having at least 16 sites, that is 8 dimers, and calculate the magnetization. But the problem is that if you do that, you get a uniform magnetization, because somehow the hand waving picture is that all the eight states are coupled by the periodic boundary condition, and you get a linear combination of them and you get a uniform magnetization. So that was a real problem. We didn't know how to do it. Usually in spin pile system, what you do is to add a small field to break the symmetry. But here, we don't want to bias the calculation. We don't know what the symmetry is. So we didn't know which field to apply to the system. So finally, the idea we had was to put some physics into the problem and couple to the lattice. There was some very specific motivation for that, because it was observed by Wolf and collaborators in Lüthi's group in Germany that before the plateau, there are very strong anomalies of the sound velocity. So the system is clearly coupled to the lattice. The lattice has to have a reaction. And we decided to play again the same game and to couple the system to classical phonons, adiabatic, in a magnetic field, and try to see if the system will select one of these states and at the same time will produce some distortion. So the result is that we get, of course, an eightfold degenerate ground state, because there are eight different ways of distorting the lattice, each of them equivalent for periodic boundary condition. But we have no coupling between these states for classical phonons, and so we end up with a given spin texture. And so coming back to this question of the square versus the tilted lattice, it was clear from the beginning that the square lattice is out, because there aren't enough different sites. On the square lattice, just by symmetry, looking at the position of the site between the unit cells, there are only six different sites, and eight if you include some interplane coupling. Whereas for the tilted lattice, we have eight different sites per layer, and we come up with 12 different sites if we have some residual interplane coupling. So I will concentrate from now on the tilted case, because we cannot decide between them. This is just on base, on experimental grounds. And what we found was the following. So if we do a calculation, we couple exactly like before the system to the lattice. We let the lattice choose the best position to minimize the energy. And it turns out that the magnetization structure is very complicated. That was a big surprise, but that's the way it is. And in fact, you can, once you find it, you can understand it. Basically, we have indeed triplets, strongly polarized triplets, making a unit cell. But inside, there are like Friedel oscillations of the magnetization. This pin here feels such a large exchange from this triplet that it is going to polarize opposite to the magnetic field, opposite to the direction where it should be. Then this one, feeling this field, is again very strongly polarized, and then it dies off slowly inside the unit cell. So that's the kind of spin texture we could come up with. And I will not enter the details of the comparison. Quantitatively, it works pretty well. We don't find so many peaks inside. So there are still some things. But this is my last slide before the conclusions. We can understand all the qualitative features of the spectrum very easily. The strongly polarized sites is giving rise to this well-defined structure here. The side which is polarized in the other side gives rise to this structure, which is opposite to the magnetic field, which are the biggest surprise to the experimentalists, because usually when they put a system in a field, they expect all the spins to polarize along the field. Then we have the next one, which explains this yellow, and all the remaining peaks that explain this forest of peaks here, more or less. So there is now the possibility to study this this system. And it's just starting. We started, the transition seems to be first order, for instance. There are many aspects of the transition that we are going to study now. And I think the particularly interesting aspect of this system is that we have access to very high commensurability. I believe for the metal insulated transition, usually the kinetic energy is so big that you access metal insulated transition at half filling, sometimes at quarter filling. But here, because of the frustration, the kinetic energy of the triplet is totally reduced, and we have really access to very high commensurability. And I believe that the nature of the transition is going to be different, first order versus second order, or such aspects. Okay, I was a little bit too long, but there was a bug in between. So anyway. So the conclusions, the very, very brief conclusions. If we think of classical frustrated magnets, either they have long-range order, or they have an infinite degeneracy with possibly some lifting of the degeneracy at finite temperature due to thermal fluctuations. Now, if we look at their quantum analogs, it's much, much richer. Now, that's very clear. There are a number of well-defined things like order by disorder plus an Ising transition in one system. We have all different kinds of spin liquids. Some systems are simply gapped from the point of view of their low energy states, but they have another physics interesting and related frustration, which is magnetization plateaus. We have also, we believe, some kind of RVB physics going on with a lot of low-lying singlets. There is something I did not discuss today here, which is the apparent spin glass behavior in SCGO and other frustrated magnets, which is still pretty much controversial experimentally, whether this is due or not to some residual disorder. But that's, again, a very interesting physics. And I'm sure there will be more surprises around the corner. And finally, I will not comment it, but I just put my list of collaborators, and particularly very useful collaborations with chemists and experimentalists. Thank you very much.
More questions?
Yep. Yes, Patrick.
Concerning the texture in the plateaus, would it be possible to look at them by neutron scattering, or is it hopeless? These are obviously not easy conditions.
Yeah, it would be, I think it's a technical problem. I think nobody is able to do neutron scattering at 35 mK in 27 Tesla. The temperature is very important. We know so far the analysis inside the plateau region was done at two temperatures, 35 mK and 1.5 K. At 1.5, everything has been washed out. So the transition is taking place at very low temperature. So it's unfortunately, at least in the near future, there is no hope to measure this plateau here.
It could be a total force.
Yeah. I think the hope is to come up with similar systems where the action is taking place at lower fields. There is no, you know, the typical value of the field is just the exchange. This system has a convenient exchange. They're not too big. You know, if they were like three or four times smaller, we would be probably even happier.
When you have those magnetization plateaus, the value of the magnetization there, is it something universal that you expect, or is that something system dependent, or
well,
what determines the value?
Well, the value is just the saturation multiplied by a rational fraction of the saturation value, I think. It's very much like the commensurability in the metal insulator transition.
Right. So in the absence of spin orbit coupling, that those things should be like fractional, should be integers or rational numbers.
Yes. That's the expectation. And this is the observation.
That's also the observation?
This is the observation. Yeah, this plateau, that's
because
pretty much.
If we have spin orbit coupling, that's not true.
So probably it's not. You mean it's going to change a little bit the value of the
magnetization?
Yeah.
It's no longer a conserved quantity, so.
The thing is, probably the absolute value is non-universal. What they always plot is the value in units of the saturation value, which they measure.
I see.
And then in that case, it is a rational number. But the saturation value might be a little bit, you know, not really one Bohr magneton per spin. That's correct. It's only in these units. It's probably not universal like the quantum Hall effect gives
right.
A universal value of the conductance.
They use this sort of fermionic analog. The plateau. These spin textures in the plateau correspond to what? To some sort of phase separation in the fermions? Or?
Well, that would be some local density. The problem, you know, is the analog I used in 1D, I cheated a little bit there, because of course you cannot do the same in 2D.
Sure, I understand.
It's more bosonic, presumably. If you do a mapping in 2D, the statistic would be more bosonic than fermionic. And but I think that would correspond to some density density texture inside the plateau. Some charge, maybe we can call it a charge density wave associated to the plateau, to the insulating phase.
I just have a sort of related question. Is this spin texture, is that some indication from numerically or just a picture?
So what do you mean? Experimentally, that's clear. So I'm not sure I understand your question. Yes, we found it, you know, the calculation we did coupled to phonons, this is really what we found. That is, once we have coupled the system to phonons, there will be a small distortion. making, for instance, this bond a little bit shorter than this bond, for instance. There is a small distortion, and then we come up with, for the system coupled to the phonon, to a unique ground state, non-degenerate, and if we calculate, this is in a magnetic field, in the state SD total equals 1 for this unit cell, and then what we plot here is the mean value of SIZ in that structure. The phonon has broken the translational symmetry, and this is really the texture we observe in the ground state of our calculation.
But in the absence of coupling to phonons, can you also...
So, in the absence, that's a problem. Then you do not have a local magnetization, because the periodic boundary condition that you would impose on a small cluster coupled different states, so that, I mean, when I said the magnetization is uniform, in fact, the ground state is twofold degenerate, and it contains a state with uniform magnetization. But this is, of course, a finite size effect, and there is no way we can go to larger systems. But physically, the compound, I'm sure there is such a breaking of the lattice symmetry. There are anomalies in the sound velocity, and this spin texture has to be accompanied by a breaking of the lattice symmetry.
There's some mapping to some theoretical models that might
be... Well, I think like in the spin piles, it's very similar to the spin piles for that matter, I suppose. So you can couple to a field. But the thing is, why ultimately don't we have any linear combination? For an infinite system, we have still 8 degenerate ground states, but I suppose there is some impurity. I mean, it's like in the spin piles. Why do you choose one of the states and not the other? Why don't you have a linear superposition of the state? This is it's just an experimental fact, presumably linked to impurity opinion.
Yeah.